Hi, this is Mike McNamara, and you're listening to All Marine Radio on your home for it, the one and only All Warrior Radio Network. Joining me through the wonder of modern technology is the one and only Grant Newsham. Grant, good morning. How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Are you still in Taiwan? Taipei?
Yes, that's right.
You're in both?
No. Well, yes, I am. I'm in Taipei, Taiwan.
Thank you. That's just a listening comprehension portion of the program right there. What about, so we might meet in Hawaii, yes?
Maybe, if you said you're going to be there three times.
And yes, how about that?
I think gives you a 1 in 3 chance, perhaps. Or so. Yeah, we'll see. We'll be down in Chinatown with some bat soup if we do connect.
I think I'll love watching you consume that. Here's what I want, though. I'm going there, you know, on the Air Force dime. And what I want is I want the VIP tour of Pearl Harbor. Like the secret tour that they give, right? Like, okay, we're going to show you the good stuff. So that's what I really want.
Huh. Well, you must have clout.
I do. Well, I don't. I don't really. But I'm getting some. I'm getting some because I'm meeting important people because of the work I'm doing. So, yeah. So, yeah.
I wasn't really joking. But
no, I know it's true. And then what I do is I ask them for very pedestrian things, and they're tickled. Like this knave wants like trinkets and beads, and you know, and they'll give us Manhattan. Yes, I will. I'll give it to you. Okay, I want to talk general stuff with you, and then we'll turn our attention to the Pacific Rim. I'm curious about your thoughts about Afghanistan. We made one of the weakest deals I've ever seen made. And as I get out my secret decoder ring and analyze the deal, to me, it is the Vietnamization of the Afghan war. We want out of it, and it is a weak deal, and we're okay with that. And we're telling our Afghan federal brothers in the government, we're leaving. Okay, we've done enough. You better get your shit together because the Taliban's going to come for your ass. And you know, President Trump has an election coming up, and that's driving the strategy. And so we seem to be message sending to the federal government because you can't look at that deal and think any other thing that we negotiated for months to get this piece of shit. Like, that Calizay dude, like, he clearly hasn't been in business for himself. He must have been in the employ of some government someplace because nobody could feed themselves making deals like this. So I'm curious, as you kind of watched all this, your thoughts on what seems to be our exit strategy from Afghanistan.
Oh, boy. I haven't read the entire, though. I just read a little bit in the newspaper, but it is wow. You know, you just left kind of going, wow, is this the best they could come up with? Just a little context. I remember in about whenever that was, 90 or 91 or so, 92, when the regime of Najibullah fell. So that was sort of the end of the Charlie Wilson War, a little bit. And I can remember the speed with which the State Department, USAID, everyone else just wanted out of Afghanistan, like right after they had kind of won. But I mean, and this was, I was sort of new to all of this stuff and sort of how governments behave. But it was just unseemly. It was insane that nobody had any interest in going in there and fixing it. So I'm not entirely surprised that, we managed to get this horrible a deal. You hardly know what to say. You know, that's not to say that we should put everything we've got into Afghanistan, because it has been an expensive distraction ultimately. $45 billion a year that to try and turn the place into a liberal democracy. What they should have aimed for was to take it back to what it was like when my hippie brother went through in 1973. It was Afghanistan, and that's what they should have tried to do instead of this central government nonsense, women's rights and empowerment as the solution. But with this deal, I would note the fella who's negotiated it has appeared. He's been around a long time, and he's always had a mixed reputation in terms of being the smartest guy in the room, and also some question as to who, what his ultimate objectives are, and who he actually negotiates for. So this is it's depressing, but so you hardly are left know what to say. But I had a young Marine major. This was probably a couple years ago. We were emailing about Afghanistan, and I remember he sent me the little message, and he had in it, you know, "Sir, I think we want to lose." And sometimes when you look at what we've done in Afghanistan, you do get that impression, although you, by looking at the way end of tour awards and upward promotions have gone for senior officers, it would seem we should have won a long time ago.
I thought we did. If you read the narrative on those, the summary of actions and all that kind of stuff, right, and the award citation, clearly we won a long time ago. Because we have made an awful lot of progress and made a huge difference there, right?
Yeah. So I'm not impressed with the, you know, I can understand trying to sort of finish the thing, but the just looking at what has been reported about the deal, it does have a Vietnamese ring to it. You do kind of get a sense that, you know, as soon as we're cooled down to a certain level, that, you know, the Taliban, and you have to keep in mind what they actually are, but that sort of conglomeration of Pashtun tribes backed by Pakistani ISI, that they will get the ascendancy, and the central government is going to last about as long as our money and our support do. So, you know, we'll see how it plays out, but you do wish that, you know, the U.S. government, with all its resources and smart people around, could come up with something better than this. You know, hopefully it's not as bad as the Iran deal that the Obama administration cut, but, you know, we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
The Obama administration, not only, I mean, the Iran deal on top of the way he leaves Iraq. I mean, talk about village idiot stuff. I mean, you look back at that and you think, and people are stunned when I say Barack Obama is going to go down as one of the weakest presidents in American history. You should see the looks on their faces. What? Maybe one of the nicest men as presidents ever, right? Seems like a wonderful human being. But as a president, he's afraid to be the president of the United States. He didn't see America as an exceptional place for just another country in the mix. And it ain't that way around the world. And people look to us for leadership, and he didn't see it that way. But they're stunned when I say that. What? Barack Obama? We're talking about the same Barack Obama. Yeah, the guy who wasn't born in the United States, right? The guy, right? Yeah, that guy. They're like, don't even go there. I said, I'm kidding, okay? But weak, you know, weak. Bent over to the Chinese, bent over to the North Koreans. You know, clown show, man, clown show. But they're, yeah, I'm, and so to me, why, so, when I analyze something, it's always like the first thing is, okay, let's assume that we're not stupid. We negotiated this deal for a reason. What would that reason be? And the reason to me is the Vietnamization of the Afghan war, peace with honor.
Yeah, that comes to mind. The excuse, of course, is, well, it's been, you know, 20 years we've been there. We can't be there forever. And then the cliche that gets trotted out is, oh, they have to want it more than us. You know, there's a certain amount of truth, but those really do become like Hallmark greeting card messages that aren't quite as sort of useful as a guide for foreign policy as one would think. You know, this whole Afghanistan thing really has been just depressing almost from the start, I would say, from that first initial attempt to bomb the Taliban Air Force into submission, and then they didn't roll over like anyone planned. And, you know, and then it just, you hardly know what to say. And it is unfortunate. And you know, this is a bipartisan achievement from my way of thinking. But you do think if this is the best deal that they could cut, holy cow. And once again, it does depend, I think it does depend on who's negotiating and why they let this fellow have the lead on it is strange. Additionally, you look at it from the Afghan central government's perspective, it appears to have been negotiated over these months, years, independent of the Afghan central government. So you have this sort of American proconsul negotiating with whomever these Taliban representatives are, reaching a deal. And then he tells the Afghan central government what the deal is. Boy, that certainly is a confidence booster for the Afghan government. And not to mention, it does kind of make it look like they are our puppets. They're not, but they it does have that appearance. So the whole thing is an embarrassment. And once again, for those of us who had some involvement in it in the first sort of before 2001, it's pretty familiar. It seems that just this inability of the United States, which is not exactly chopped liver, to sort of accomplish a desirable end. Either by force or negotiation or a combination of the two. So it would be nice to see on the military side, just looking at the way the Afghan business has been regarded, which is these string of successful 9-month campaigns, somebody have some sort of introspection and try and figure out what happened and not do it again. If you read some history, when the General Stilwell were driven out of Burma, he was quoted in the press as saying, "Well, this is humiliating as hell. I propose we find out what happened and go back and take the place." But what we have is, I don't see a similar degree of introspection or admission of lack of success on the part of the military's ruling class. It may be mean, and there may be a few exceptions that I'm not aware of. In fact, I can think of one. But by and large, I wish we would learn the lessons from it and not do it again.
Riddle me this, Grant. I have a very bad feeling in my head and in my heart for Generals Franks and Myers. Franks as CENTCOM, Myers as the chief of staff, as the chairman. And they, like we, grew up, right? They're both Vietnam veterans. I didn't know that. I thought Franks was a post-Vietnam guy, and I thought Myers was too, right? But I should have known. They're 10 years... or so senior Neller, which would have made them smack dab in the Vietnam War. And they were. All right. Myers flew out of Thailand, missions over Vietnam. And Franks, I think, was an Artie guy in Vietnam. And so, the whole mantra of post-Vietnam was what? Never again will we go someplace without a clearly defined mission, right? And without our military leaders making sure that this is something that the American military should be doing. And that was the coronation of all that was Desert Storm. Right? We went down, we went against the only idiot that would lay down in the desert exactly how we practice it for like 30 years. Right? And we blow the living shit out of them. Right? And with hardly any casualties. So they betrayed that. And I judge them harshly for that. That was the crowning achievement. Combine them with Colin Powell, All of them Vietnam veterans. And Grant, you know how we heard that shit all the time, right? We both joined in the 80s, I think, you know, and now you heard these Vietnam guys, man, they were all over, they were the Marine Corps that we joined. They were the senior guys. Never again, never again, never again. The lessons of Vietnam. And then they betrayed it all. And so our inability to power project in Lebanon, in Somalia, right, in Iraq, and Afghanistan, and have the appropriate outcome comes to us, the one lesson should be never, ever intervene as Americans. It never leads to anything good. We cannot do that. We don't wield the military power with political end states that are properly articulated and that we're ready to stick to. So don't intervene. Only fight wars of a defensive nature after somebody has set upon you. And we will save ourselves a lot of money and a lot of heartache as a nation. Your thoughts on that?
Oh, well, I don't mind intervening when it's right. So we'd probably perhaps differ a bit on that.
But we can't do it. When has we ever done it fucking well?
Well, we do well for a little while, at least.
Oh, there you go. That's your defense of this intellectually?
Well, yeah.
You want me to browbeat you, don't you? If you do, yes, just tell me, Mac, browbeat me because I.
Because it's the bat soup talking, so don't don't worry. So I do think that you choose your fights and then you win them. It, just because we've had had great success over the long run in these things, I don't think is a reason not to do it. You have to be willing to go in on occasion. And they do things. So that doesn't bother me so much, but I do wish we would do better. And, you know, one thing you notice that, how'd you put it, with the Afghan business, it was actually kind of a winnable war in my opinion. But it tends to, once we went in, at some point, it's as if we stopped thinking, or better said, we stopped listening to the people who do think. Quite know how to put it, but I remember around 2010, I was asked by one of the generals at Marfor Pak to write up something on how to keep the Taliban from resurging, and I did. And I pointed out first they had already resurged, actually. But I gave him 4,000 words on it or so and summarized it and down to some sort of bullet point things. And one of them was, the last one was, I gave him actually 8 or 9 bullet points, which were good. And the ninth one was, leave it up to the captains and the majors, and numbers 1 through 8 will take care of themselves. And I wasn't really joking, because there's always been, I thought, very good clarity at the lower ranks of what needed to do, what would you do that would give you a better chance of success, or what should you stop doing if you wanted to win or be more successful in Afghanistan. And I say it was easy to find at the lower ranks, at the top ranks, the top levels, you just never, if it was there, it was really well hidden. So I'm not quite as opposed to getting in, but I do wish we'd listen to more people.
Well, Grant, think about it. You don't have to talk about this, but the expansion of the ground war in Afghanistan, this whole idea, and you just alluded to it a few minutes ago, the creation of a federal government which never existed there, rights for women that doesn't exist in the entire region, right, and some form of liberal democracy representative government, all of which has never existed, to include the national infrastructure relative to the military and the police that has never existed. It has been a series of city-states and the rural areas run by, by the people that run those. And then we set out on a different mission that we could conclude in, 5 years maybe? Won't take us that long. 5 years, that means what? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 rotations, a couple of different guys in ahead of it, right? Meritorious legions of merit for those guys, ribbons and medals for everybody else, and boom, we'll have a democracy. It's as stupid as what we did in Afghanistan. It's as stupid as what we did in Iraq. Oh, no problem. We'll just flip a nation, It's got three fucked up organizations or ethnic groups inside of it, right? All condemned by the power of the British pencil when it drew boundaries over 100 years ago and put them in the same box. And we'll go in there and we'll flip governments. We'll bring in some expats. No problem. Jay Gardner's going to... I mean, it's like, are you shitting me?
Yeah. Oh, I'm with you. There's when they let Bin Laden and his guys out of Tora Bora, that wasn't the way to get started. And it's, you know, as I said, if they had aimed to turn it into what it was when my hippie brother was there, and it was kind of the place the hippies went and had a good time. And you could go and survive, but it was not a modern place, but it was just Afghanistan. And it's not entirely the military's fault. In fact, I would like to think it's not mostly theirs, although I wish things had been done differently. But certainly administrations had some responsibility for that, for what happened in Afghanistan. It's ultimately a political question. But it also became something of a racket. Pretty early on, which is you could make an absolute fortune in the, you know, if you could tap into government contracts and all the money being poured into the place. And that is, you know, besides the human cost of Afghan and American lives, it is the financial expense of this. If you calculate it and think of what you could have done with that money elsewhere, say to make anti-ship missiles that go as farther and faster than Chinese ones do, that's where another tragedy took place that could ultimately kill us, because we spent so much money, devoted so much attention to Afghanistan, for crying out loud, that the Chinese got the jump on us, and in certain circumstances in Asia could defeat us. And you hardly know what to say.
Yeah. No, it is, and now we're trying to get the hell out of there because we've got an election deadline coming up. And then no sooner have we celebrated this thing than the Taliban launch offensive operations all over the country again. My fear is that now you've got a B-team guy like Secretary Esper. Is he going to speak truth to power? Everybody says they will, but nobody ever fucking does. And so now it's like, well, you know, this is not outside the parameters of the agreement, blah, 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 blah. Yes, it is. Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah, certainly the spirit of it. You know, as noted, when I heard who was negotiating for us, you knew exactly what was going to happen. Put it that way.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. There's one other thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of international stuff. What are your thoughts on Iran? Iran just had, in spite of their the Ayatollah coming out, Khomeini, and telling everybody it was a religious duty to vote, they had the lowest voter turnout since 1979, which was the year of the revolution. And the distance between the electorate and the people there and the government, it seems to be growing and growing and growing. Do you pay attention at all to Iran?
I follow it. I think probably, like, you know, people our age who are, you know, interested in foreign affairs, I think by definition we pay attention to Iran. It's interesting to see how that plays out. You always wonder exactly when it's going to change. Would be nice, you know, I think one of the best things that could happen in the Middle East is if somehow the Persian could sort of get out from underneath this regime that runs the place. And, you know, the regime does have a degree of support, of course, but at the same time, it's not as if I haven't met a species of humans that enjoy being oppressed and living in a place with a crappy economy. And a corrupt government. We'll see how that plays out. But it would be nice, I say, if that sort of Persia was allowed to sort of reemerge as a decent country, sort of a country that didn't kill people. That would be a nice start. But you wonder sometimes it does take generational change, and they've had almost two generations now. So I hope they don't have to wait too many more to have things finally shift in the right direction. But you know, when you do have the Revolutionary Guards, these the IRGC, these guys want to make the Taliban look kind of nice, or excuse me, make Al-Qaeda look nice. So you do have a very nasty set of people that run the place and dominate the, not in Cambodia, control the economy, and run a pretty sweet racket, ultimately, that kills people. And it's been a problem since 1978 that I can remember, and is no less of a problem today than it was. Maybe there's a little more chance of a sort of a change there, but you know, I've given up trying to predict exactly when that will happen. Our best chance, I think, was, what was that, 2009, during the so-called Green Revolution in Iran,
right,
when you had about 1 million people in Iran on the streets protesting a stolen, corrupt election. And the Obama administration didn't say a word, not even a peep in sort of moral support of these people. The idea was that the mullahs, the ruling government, would appreciate the forbearance on the American part and respond by becoming nice people. That was as embarrassing as anything I have ever seen an American administration do. Couldn't even put out a good word on behalf of these people who went out on the streets. A lot of them got shot. And then afterwards, quietly, the regime cracked down and disappeared a lot of people. And the opposition there has never been the same ever since. So thank you very much to that community organizer from Chicago.
Yeah, you don't want to piss off the Iranians.
Yeah,
God forbid that.
You've always remember when with the Reagan administration and other ones, they've all been looking for the Iranian moderate. You know, that's like going to look for unicorns or something. There's not many of them. Successive administrations have done some pretty strange things when it comes to Iran. I think this one has done some better things. So we'll see how this plays out. But, you know, it would be nice, as I said, to see Persia reemerge as a country that doesn't hurt people. And that would be a nice thing. More than anything, I think that would help fix, in as much as one does, the Middle East.
Yeah. The catalyst of much of what you see in Somalia, in Yemen. Right. I mean, all of a sudden those things go back inside their banks, and you have reasonable people that aren't getting international funding from these people to continue to conduct these proxy wars. And all of a sudden that goes down. And then I'm curious. It's you're an intel guy. And as we continue to talk about intel stuff and situations around the world, Turkey has got itself into an interesting little spot. Right. Thumb their nose at NATO. Tell the United States to piss off, we'll buy Russian anti-air missiles. And then got 33 guys killed, ran straight to NATO and said, we need to convene a meeting of the NATO ministers, and we'd like your help. Any thoughts on how that ends?
I don't know. Like, my answer to most things seems to be, I don't know. But it is sort of... When this gets sort of whiplash watching this, it's been exactly as you've described, even a little worse, actually, because this Erdogan fellow who runs Turkey, give him a beard and he could he could run Afghanistan, could run the Taliban. He's not a good guy. Even when you discount for Turkey's interests in the region, which are not well understood, by our side, or at least that by people on our side do understand them, but in general, there isn't a wide understanding that Turkey does have some security interests and political interests in the region. But Erdogan has, he is really an Islamic extremist. And he has, as you know, he's gotten himself into maybe some trouble, or at least he's gotten himself into a shoot up, in Syria. And it is funny, and his relationship with the Iranians, I can think of at least three or four times that it seems to have shifted almost overnight from hatred to sort of being friends to hatred again and back and forth. And, you know, and then when he calls back to NATO, it just says, please help us. that is kind of funny. And at the same time, he's threatening Europe to unleash millions and millions of refugees or into Europe again if he doesn't get what he wants. So his sort of presence, I would have to say, has not been particularly helpful over the last decade, at least.
Interesting. I got an email question for you. Ask Grant when he comes on what the virus is doing to China's soft currency. So first of all, explain the soft currency issue that, you know, is characterizes China, Russia, and other totalitarian regimes around the world.
It's not doing good things to it, and it is exposing, I think, one of the problems we've talked about with sort of the question of Chinese power, as it particularly financial power, is that it's there's two things to consider. One is that the results of any time an economy seizes up, you know, it just stops. You know, factories shut. Places where people work are closed. People can't go outside. They can't travel. Just think of the effects of that. You know, we've never seen anything like that in the United States. You know, even after our financial collapse, things still pretty much, you know, you had a place to go for a job and, you know, things still continued. But China just stopped. And, you know, so what happens then, you know, to your economy? You know, you look at this collection of all the things that people do to sort of make a living, to make money, to make things, sell things, buy things, that creates an economic vitality. And it just suddenly stops. And if you put yourself in the position of the guys that run China, what exactly do you do to fix that? You know, and you've got to get the economy going again. You've got to get people out and about, and you've got to reestablish confidence. And that alone is a challenge. So but China has a double problem. And but before I get to the second one, in order to get the economy going again, of course you have to have enough money around. And in China's case, that means Chinese money, the yuan or the renminbi, the RMB. So they can actually print any amount of that they want because they have the printing presses. So it's, you know, they can, but what do you do? You know, do you actually say, do you give every person in China $1 million to tell them to go out and spend? Well, if you do that and say factories and are not making things, that then you have a nation of millionaires that are all looking to buy the same things. And then you get inflation of about 1,000,000% a day. And that brings down the government. There's nothing for people to buy. There's nothing for them to eat. So that means if you just pour a lot of local money into the economy. So they've got a huge problem just with trying to restart the economy, but they have a bigger problem, a double problem. And the second part is that their money is pretty much useless overseas. So if China wants to buy oil, food, iron ore, wants to fund a Belt and Road project, if it wants to buy a company overseas, it needs to pay in convertible currency, which is dollars. Ultimately, you know, euros will do well, sometimes Japanese yen or Swiss francs, etc. But it has to be money somebody wants. So if the Chinese economy is not selling things for export, it's not earning any convertible currency to buy all these things overseas that they need to buy. Additionally, if the economy is in trouble in China, that foreign companies aren't so interested in investing in China anymore, and that one, it provides them with foreign currency. It also provides a boost in terms of employment, etc. And also they can make more money from exporting, goods that foreign companies make in China. So they're running out of convertible currency. You know, it said, well, they have $3 trillion in reserves. Well, that's not much money at all, and that will disappear very quickly. So it's that double problem is how do you restart your economy? And that's not easily done. And then there's the second part, which is that your currency is not freely convertible. So overseas, nobody wants it. So if you put yourself, say, in the position of the Confederate States of America, that, you know, if Jefferson Davis wanted to buy Enfield rifles from England or buy medicines or silks, et cetera, he had to pay in Yankee greenbacks. And that he didn't have enough of them. And you, the Chinese government faces the same basic problem. It may differ in the specifics, but it is the same same problem that Jefferson Davis faced, that Zimbabwe faced, Venezuela faced, if you don't have enough foreign currency. But don't worry, there's something that's coming to the rescue and has been for a while, and that's the U.S. financial industry, which is hell-bent to invest your money, if you have a retirement fund, either private or public, invest it in the PRC in China. So they will be pumping in, if everything goes the way they plan it, they will be pumping in probably a couple hundred billion dollars over maybe the next year or two into China. And it is as if the New York bankers had invested in the Confederate States of America while we were fighting them. Whether or not Congress will stop this, I don't know. But that's the sort of from the Chinese government's perspective, that would be the bright side, is the American financial industry trying to pour our money into China so they can use it to defeat us ultimately. It sounds crazy, but that is effectively what's going on. But but without the American financial support that appears to be, has started and may play out in even worse than I've noted, without that, you can see the real challenge that the Chinese regime has just to get the economy going. And if they don't do that, they've got a financial problem and a real political problem and a social problem. But it's compounded by the absence of the money that they need to buy things overseas. And it's very interesting to watch that play out, but it's surprising how little coverage that issue of China having a dual currency system with a domestic currency and a sort of and the need for foreign currency. And it doesn't get much attention in the press or the millions of words that get written each day about the situation in China.
Why would you write something about that when you could cover bat stew, right?
Oh, I have no idea why, but I've had 850 words coming on this topic for a few weeks now, but being one of the laziest people on the planet, I haven't quite gotten to it yet. But it's such an interesting, if I can figure something out, it's not as if, you have to be a genius to figure it out,
You can find it, but you find it, it's buried in the think tanks of Brookings and CSIS, right?
Brookings. They get Chinese money. That would be funny. General John Allen is with the Marines. He runs Brookings.
Right.
Brookings is considered almost an adjunct of the Chinese Communist Party. That overstates it, actually. But they are the ones that certainly seem pretty well disposed towards the People's Republic of China. Unfortunately, but your point is well taken. I just had to throw that out because Brookings has been in mind lately. There's other people who know this. It's not as if I figured it out entirely on my own.
No, but I mean when you can, for instance, I have a guy who comes on. His name's Alex Hollings, and he's a writer, and he talks about in the media the necessity of publishing Liz Hurley bikini pictures. And he says, you need that traffic. He said, now, if you notice when these things pop up, you'll see that they're promulgated by like Fox News, by CNN. You'll see them. Why would those major news outlets traffic in that kind of stuff? The answer, because they get millions and millions and millions of hits. And when you say, look, this is the kind of traffic we're driving through our news, part of it is essentially news porn. And that is the bat soup story is always going to have bazillion more clicks than the truth of hard currency and why the Chinese, you know, are in such a difficult position. And the United States, geez, might be able to take, you know, some kind of financial measures in limiting, you know, the investment of American. I mean, it's just like, Grant, it's like, okay, well, what about drugs for the coronavirus? Well, none of them are made in the United States. What? Yeah, they're all made in China. Holy shit. What? Okay, so what about, okay, face masks for everybody. Those are all made in China, too. What? Right? So you're looking around, it's like, how did we get here? And the things that you're talking about are the things that have been, you know, we've looked aside, as they have not allowed American companies to sell into China, but we're tripping over ourselves to try to make the money that we can make off 1.3 billion people. And this is just another installment of that story, yes?
I'll take you. Yeah, you're right.
Quit stammering, for God's sakes.
Yeah, it is almost 2 o'clock in the morning.
Well, hey, it's whose fault? Whose fault is that?
Mine, entirely mine.
It's truth be told, right? Yeah, Grant pulled a Mac and forgot that we were supposed to record this last night. And I pinged him. He says, "Oh, how about 2:30 in the morning live?" I said, "No problem, no problem." So don't go there with me. All right.
Yeah, that's fine. But no, you're absolutely right. And the pharmaceutical, the medicines, the issue that you raised, this should be a national scandal that, you know, should be on everybody's lips. Congress should be not just holding hearings, but should be imprisoning executives, you know, where the American pharmaceutical industry is absolutely dependent on manufacturing in China. You know, they just haven't got enough. They don't make enough stuff elsewhere to take care of Americans. Little mention that, you know, back in the Clinton era, when Puerto Rico was a huge part of the sort of the pharmaceutical manufacturing chain, the Clinton administration basically changed some laws that undercut this and sort of encouraged the stampede to China. So in the process, you sort of undercut Puerto Rico, which has been a delicate place in the best of times, and sent it all to China. What could possibly be wrong with putting our medicine in the hands of a communist party that, by its own words, hates us and wants to displace us and dominate or destroy us if necessary? You know, how dumb do you have to be if you're the CEO or any MBA sort of owning member of the pharmaceutical industry and a lot of the rest of the U.S.
But when we discuss that, Grant, the discussion goes like this. So, right. So I'm the economic expert and saying, okay, let me tell you. So what's going to happen here is we're going to lower our cost curve down to here. Now, seeing this slide right here, you can see where the cost curve is. You can see then what happens to the profit margin, you know, for the company, right? It's going to go through the roof, boys and girls. So, and then you have your global, right, political forecaster guy and say, so, and then you're the CEO, you look at him and you say, so, McNamara, what is the risk associated with doing this in terms of global politics and whatnot? Well, like, it would have to be a pandemic of some sort, and then the Chinese would simply supply themselves and tell the rest of the world to go to hell.
Yeah.
That'll never happen.
Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Thanks, Mac. Let's do this shit. We're going to China, boys. So, yeah. that's as far as they need to see, right? Far as they need to see, because their loyalty is to their shareholders and to their wallet.
I would say their loyalty is to themselves. I wouldn't even throw the shareholders into it.
I
have some empirical, you know, observation on that. But go back to your original point is why doesn't this get the press coverage it deserves or even the congressional coverage it deserves? And that is a big issue. It is disgraceful, of course. Now, I'd mentioned the stampede of the U.S. financial industry to get into, put money into China. I say to invest your Americans' retirement savings into these index funds, say stock and bond index funds, so that the money automatically goes into Chinese shares, and it's billions of dollars. And there were some Congress people who did raise this recently. Well, the most one that has done very well is Marco Rubio from Florida.
Yes.
And there's been others, and there's Democrats, too, and they deserve plenty of credit for that. But if you read the response, there was one, it was a very lengthy response to Marco Rubio by the Thrift Savings Program, which I think a lot of military yes. people are familiar with.
Right.
That is the government. It's one of the sort of the government-private IRA sort of thing. And they wrote a very lengthy response trying to justify to Senator Rubio why it was okay to put
uh-oh. That's not supposed to happen. Uh-oh. That means
the person whom you're trying to reach is currently
you know, the Skype thing is green next to Grant's name.
The person whom you're trying to...
We know. We know. All right. We'll see if Grant comes back here in a moment. Always interesting to talk to Grant. You know, the hard currency thing, something that, you know, Bob Nielsen, who's done work all over the world, loves to track. And that was, in fact, his question today. And, but, you know, it's interesting listening to Grant, you know, talking about, you know, that Wall Street is gonna come to the rescue of the Chinese in terms of pumping billions of dollars into the country that would keep it afloat. And and again, the United States asleep the whole time, right? Asleep the whole time, you know. So it's pretty interesting when you put all the pieces together and you think, well, wait a minute, who's in charge? Oh, the same people that are in charge of this are the people that are in charge of Afghanistan. Oh, that makes sense to me. Now I got it. Let me try again. Ah!
The person whom you're trying to reach is currently unavailable. Please leave a message after the beep.
Grant, you loser. Alright. Well, we will, we'll give him a minute to figure out. We'll take a break. More of, All Marine Radio coming up. Hopefully the conclusion with Grant Newsham coming up next, right here on your home for it. The one and only All Warrior Radio Network.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of the 100 Entrepreneurs Project.
Speak of the devil.
Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nelson. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
We're going to try Grant Newsham again and see if he shows up.
Grant here.
What happened?
I don't know. I was on a roll and suddenly it got cut off.
I know. Okay, finish your thought so I can let you go to bed.
Yeah, I was just about, I was about to, like, deliver the coup de grace to these charlatans. But if you okay, that's where I was when I was on this rampage, like Archer. But I was, if you read the response by the head of the thrift savings program that has probably anybody, at least anyone who's listening, is probably part of it. If you read it, if you distill the four pages of fine print down to what it says, is it says everyone else is doing it, and that's the best they could come up with. That because other people are investing in China, are investing money into China, MSCI, Morgan Stanley Capital Index, et cetera, Bloomberg Bond Funds, et cetera, et cetera. Therefore, it's okay. So you can imagine like a fourth grade teacher yelling at like Jimmy, who jumped off of the jungle gym from 20 feet up and broke his arms. He says, well, why did you do this? And he says, well, everybody else was. And that is about the best that our financial ruling class can come up with, is that, well, everyone else is doing it. And you must think, come on now, there's a punchline here. And there really isn't. Yes, they can give a lengthy justification, but ultimately this is what it comes down to, is everyone else is doing it. And if you had a front row to the seat to the 2008 financial collapse, that was pretty much the justification on the part of Wall Street, was, well, everyone else is. So, it's easy to be pretty cynical about what our best and brightest have got going. And the Chinese must be thanking their lucky stars.
Quick update on North Korea. Anything Rocket Man is now like attempting to do rocketeering again? Is there anything other than he's making noise because that's what he does? Is there anything to that?
Well, I think there is. I think that regardless of the problems that hellhole has, and as much as a hellhole has anything other than problems, that it's just an engineering question. And I have no doubt that they will sort of get the missile technology, the delivery systems right, and shrink the nukes down to sort of the right size to put them on these delivery systems. And, that I can just see them making slow but steady progress. There's been more evidence just the other day of Chinese involvement in keeping that regime afloat by helping the North Koreans out with a huge sort of sand harvesting project, and making a ton of money for the North Koreans, which it just points out how the Chinese have been violating the UN sanctions that they promised to obey. Further reason why we really need China's help with North Korea. But so there's just some more evidence of that. But it is funny just how, when you have other things come along, North Korea seems to be a lot less of an issue. And this maybe is human nature that, we sort of lose attention. But I focus on the thing to keep looking at with North Korea is that ability to, their ability to develop weapons of sort of long-range nuclear weapons that can hurt us.
in particular. And the more, if they can hurt us, that you can bet that the friends we've got, particularly Japan, are even more worried about all of this. So it's still there. The problem just, it's gradually getting worse and worse. So that's, but there are a few other things on people's minds at the moment. Obviously, as the civilized world goes about scaring itself to death for the umpteenth time, with this coronavirus business.
Got it. The and what else, before I let you go to bed, is there anything? It doesn't sound like, unlike the hysteria that occupies the media here in the United States about the end of the world, China has not been swallowed alive by this virus as of yet. Neither has Taiwan, neither has Japan. Can you give us kind of a regional update on this whole coronavirus hysteria that we see?
You know, it's always hard to, it's kind of like you said, and I maybe see it a little different than some other people, but you do look at what's happened in China, and you do have to keep in mind that basically it's a regime that lies. And the problem was probably like 10 times worse than they ever admitted to. But it does seem as though it's kind of blowing over the way these things often do. I think Taiwan, though, has shown how a very civilized, free country responds to these things, and they've done very well. They're both transparent about it, and they put in place some sort of effective measures immediately, and saw it as a national endeavor, rather than sitting and hiding it the way the Chinese communists did and letting the thing brew up and causing all sorts of trouble worldwide. Japan is I'd made a reference to people scaring themselves to death. I think Japan's sort of, certainly in the front of the pack in terms of doing that. But they did not sort of close the border with China anywhere near as fast as they should have, and they still really haven't. And that's said to be because Abe wants to make sure that Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, comes to visit in April. He's not going to come, of course, but they let a few hundred thousand Chinese tourists into Japan right while the virus thing was brewing up in China. And that's become a public issue, actually. Prime Minister Abe is getting some criticism for that. But the Japanese government has always had a sort of what you call Chinese agents of influence in it, and the Japanese business community has never wanted to do anything that would upset the Chinese. So the Japan pretty much welcomed them in with open arms, and they've had some infections. But what they've done is they've shut closed schools for a month or two, so no children are going to school, and the public gatherings are being canceled right and left. I would have to say it is kind of panicking. You can see it resembles what we've got going in America where, once again, we've heard these things before. And, a weekend in Chicago probably produces more deaths than this virus has for, so far.
No, without a doubt. When you contrast it with what goes on around the world relative to annual influenza, right?
You're going to hear. You'll hear it a lot from if you read the coverage, and there'll always be the experts, the commentators saying it's not a question of if, or it's a question of when. And we've heard that for everything. I should have had AIDS like 20 times or died long ago of AIDS. Or Ebola or the SARS, something always comes along. So color me cynical about this. Not to say that prudent health measures and sanitary measures aren't important in any time. But for some reason it all seems familiar to me. And let's see what happens once the weather warms up. And then we'll have to wait a while for the next thing that's going to kill us all to come along.
All right.
But the psychological effects of this that manifest themselves financially, those are not to be laughed at. And since China has $3 trillion in convertible currency that people would actually want. Maybe they could use that to defray some of the damage that they've caused.
Yeah, well, I mean, you would think that's what the plan was, right?
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it is. Yeah.
Right. Their rainy day fund, if that's where their liquidity comes from. What about, you're in Taiwan, Taipei. They have not seen an explosion of it sitting so close to the Chinese mainland?
I haven't noticed it. You know, it's certainly like everyone here, everyone's got masks on, and, if they can even get masks. They've even had to put the military, including the Taiwan Marines, in to work in mask factories. And they've actually complained a little bit about having to work the late shift instead of the civilian employees doing it. If you look at the infection numbers and the death rates, and, you know, if you're one of them, boy, that's enough. But in terms from a sort of a broader perspective, that it's not huge, really at all. The government here really shows what a competent Chinese government can do, that if it wants to. So that's a pretty stark choice, and it makes Taiwan look pretty good.
Got it. All right. Well, sorry to keep you late. But you have nobody but yourself to blame. So catch up on your sleep tomorrow, and we'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Okay, pleasure. Yeah.
Well, hold on. I would be remiss if I didn't ask you. Tell everybody what's the next thing you're writing about and where they're going to see it.
I think they've got a preview of it. It's that comparing China to the Confederate States of America in terms of having a desirable currency. That's the next thing I think that's coming.
And any idea where?
Go try to get see if Asia Times is interested, and we'll see how it goes. But I'm hoping nobody listening beats me to it and takes my article ID and goes before me. But it does bring to mind, because I was talking to a guy about all this, and he referred to Confederate money, and it brought to mind that when I was very young, like, I saved a little bit of money, and I went to this antique store in the old part of downtown, or Old Town Alexandria, if you remember how crappy it used to be. And this would have been like 100 years after World War II, if that. And I bought like a piece of Confederate money, and I can't find it. And it has irked me for probably like 40 years that I can't find this Confederate money that I bought, because it's probably worth at least $3 now. I'll look forward to writing about this stuff, but feel badly the whole time since I'll remember that I can't find the thing. So, but that's it.
Got it. All right, sir. Thank you very much. Travel safe, and hopefully our paths will cross here in the next couple of months.
Okay. Well, let's see how it goes.
Right.
That'll be good.
Yeah, bets do down in Chinatown.
The best.
I'd love to watch you eat it. So, anyway. All right, Grant. Thank you.
Okay,
thank you. There you have it. Grant Newsham here on a Thursday morning. Somebody sent me an email. You know, Mac, every time I listen to Grant, I hear more stuff I don't hear on a regular basis. Why don't we hear about the incredible financial muscle that this nation has and how we continue simply to give it away and not operate in our own national interest? Well, that's because we don't require our companies to behave in concert with our federal government. It's called capitalism. It's called freedom. So now the question is, will the people that lead the nation, will they look at this and say, you know, we ought to limit that which can be invested? Yeah. We shall see. We shall see. All right, that'll do it. If you're just joining us, in the first hour, talk a little bit about Elizabeth Warren and she getting out. I was not able to hear her remarks, so I don't know where she's throwing her support to, but one would think that her progressive candidacy would be thrown behind Bernie Sanders. But I don't know if that's the smart play as it were. The smart play would be for her to remain uncommitted, if you will, maybe, and hold out hope that either in the Biden administration or the Sanders administration that Elizabeth Warren would be something substantial. So, or will she throw in with Bernie Sanders? So, I don't know yet. So anyway, we'll talk about her dropping out, and then we'll cover the news of the day. More news out of Afghanistan, none of which is very good. Seems positive for the quote-unquote peace deal that's been struck there. And so we talk about that a little bit. So don't touch that dial. Talk a little bit about the book, Post-Traumatic Winning, that's being written and worked on. So all that is hour one. And then if you're just listening, you heard Grant Newsham talking about Afghanistan, his thoughts on that. Which were not good. His thoughts on Iran, and then Turkey, and then the Middle East, and then over to the Pacific Rim, and talks about the key role of currency to the Chinese government and why this is so devastating for them. And all those investments in T-bills and bonds that they have, you might see those flooding the market. So as they generate the cash that they need to run their economy. So, interesting stuff. All right, that'll do it. On a Wednesday, All Marine Radio. The chef will join me tomorrow. Alex Hollings on Monday. You're going to meet James, who's the Bar X guy, on Tuesday. And getting veterans together and doing great things. So hopefully we'll do a little work with him. And so there you go. On a Thursday, have a great day. All Marine Radio, out.